Good afternoon, and welcome to the October meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you from the Midcoast of Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, which was founded 33 years ago by a small group of area residents with a special interest in U.S. foreign policy and our role in international affairs. We meet on a monthly basis to hear retired foreign policy officials, academics, journalists, and international businessmen discuss important foreign policy issues. Our membership, which is currently about 250, includes not just those who are interested in foreign affairs, but as well many who have lived and worked abroad and have considerable expertise about many of the issues discussed. For additional information, please visit our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker, and this is for a return engagement. He was here, I think, 6 years ago. Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter on Syrian politics that attracts over 100,000 readers a month. He travels frequently to Washington to consult with government agencies and speak at various think tanks. Most recently, he's spoken at the Woodrow Wilson Institute, the Brookings Institution, Middle East Institute, and Council on Foreign Relations, and was a recent guest on PBS NewsHour. An undergraduate at Swarthmore, he got his master's at Harvard and his doctorate at Princeton. He grew up mostly in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia and Beirut, where his family was. At one point, he spent 4 years studying in Syria. And until the Syrian civil war broke out, he spent his summers in Aleppo or Damascus. He currently visits the Middle East every year. Joshua's topic today is ISIS, ethnic cleansing, and nation building in the Middle East. So warm welcome.
Thank you very much. Let me dive in to my topic today. And what I want to do is try to put ISIS and the crisis in Iraq and Syria into a broader historical context, a context of nation building and identity. I'm going to make a narrow argument about identity. I could talk about economics, which is very important, poor versus rich, about countryside versus city, about foreign involvement and proxy wars, all of which are fundamental to understanding what's going on. But for the purposes of today and being brief, I'm going to talk about one thing, identity, nationalism. And I'm going to use a conceit, and that conceit is to compare what's happening in the Levant today, the Middle Eastern countries of the Northern Middle East, to Central Europe. Why? The class of 1919, all of these countries, from Poland down to Palestine, were created at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 after World War I. And World War I has often been called the empire-destroying war. It proved, if anything needed to, that nation states were a much better way to organize people than empires. They could get lots more soldiers to die on the battlefront. And so in a very Darwinian way, they would win. And they destroyed these multi-ethnic, multi-religious empires. And they drew borders, created nations, and expected people from many different backgrounds who were trapped in these new borders to form a political community of trust. And in almost every case, these new nation states in Central Europe and the Ottoman Empire failed spectacularly and ended up in what I've called the Great Sorting Out. And that took place in Europe largely during World War II, where the borders weren't changed to fit the people. The people were changed to fit the borders. And that meant tons of ethnic cleansing, lots of refugees pouring out of Central Europe. Some people, like the Jews, were exterminated because they didn't have a nation to go to and were vilified. But a massive transformation of peoples, long and bloody. In Europe, it's largely the process of the great sorting out, I would argue, is largely finished. Although in Ukraine, we can see this is still going on, places like Crimea. Yugoslavia, of course, exploded in 1990, was divided into seven nation states after lots of ethnic cleansing and so on. But in large part, that process of nation building and flattening society, destroying minorities, creating homogeneous people that trust each other, don't see the other as a fifth column, has taken place in much of Europe. In post-Ottoman states, I would argue to you that process is going on today, and that's what we're seeing. Let me just remind you of something like Poland. Poland, between 44 and 48, this is at the end of the war, 31 million people were ethnically cleansed in Central and Eastern Europe. In Poland, 68% of Poles, of the people in Poland, were Polish before the war. By the end of the war, 100% are Polish. What happens to that other 32%? 3 million Jews were killed during the war or fled if they could. But from 1945 to 1950, 7 million Germans were expelled from Poland and Eastern Prussia. Eastern Prussia, of course, is up there, Königsberg, the head of it. The Russians took that over. Little Königsberg was a city of 350,000. 60,000 of those were Jews who were killed during the war. But then the Germans were enslaved by the Russians. And by 1950, there were 20,000 left, and they went to Germany. This is the city of Kant, of many other illustrious Germans. But they all disappeared. This is not mentioning the Ukrainians, Lithuanians, and others who were also ethnically cleansed. If we just look down at Austro-Hungarian Empire, which of course was destroyed during World War I, and we look just at Czechoslovakia. Czechoslovakia was 32% minorities before World War II. There are no minorities left by the end of World War II. From 45 to 47, 3 million Germans, Sudeten Germans, were ethnically cleansed. And others as well, but that's taking place in every one of these different countries. This great sorting out, a brutal redistribution. Let us look at Germans. Here is the German population of Central and Eastern Europe, scattered around, about 12 or 13 million strong. Hitler, of course, thought he was going to gather all these people up in a gross Deutsch, in a bigger Germany, and create a giant Germany and get rid of the Slavs or make them turn them to servants and so forth. He fails, but all those Germans become the guilty minority. Many of them have been sucked into collaborating with Hitler. You look at the little Germans of Crimea, which has been in the news so much. 6% of Crimeans were German before World War II. Hitler conquers it, uses that 6% as a collaborative elite. Stalin retakes it. They're marched off to Siberia, get killed, or flee. There are no more Germans in Crimea. Of course, Stalin also marched off all the Crimean Tatars to Siberia. But this giant ethnic cleansing, all those Germans were ethnically cleansed between 45 and 48, 12 million of them from Central Eastern Europe. So this is the great sorting out. And it's part of the nation-building process. And let me spend 2 minutes on nationalism, because nationalism is something new. It's modern. And lots of people will criticize me in this talk and say, well, you're talking about primordial identities as if they've always existed. That's only partly true. Really, what I'm talking about is a very modern transformation of using religion and ethnicity to create a modern political community. And nationalism is a very dramatic revolution because it's changing the great chain of being that predominated in the Middle Ages, a way to look at human society in which you had God in his heaven, angels, different levels of heaven, a king, aristocracy, a bourgeoisie, commoners, various levels of the unfree, serfs, indentured servants, slaves, and then down to animals and demons, and down to the devil, I guess, at the end of all the circles of hell. But that giant chain of being gets completely collapsed in the Enlightenment, and we get to all men are created equal. And it changes authority 180 degrees because the sovereigns become servants and the subjects become sovereign. In other words, the people who were the subjects become the sovereigns. And today in the United States or in any democracy, in any nation state, it's the people who are sovereign. And our rulers run around telling us that they're public servants and they thank you for being able to serve you and so forth. And that's what we're hearing in this election cycle. I guess less serving than usual, but this is a 180 degree turn. And it democracy, and in some ways, is the fulfillment of nationalism. It takes a long time. Only half of the nation states in the world perhaps have democracy. But it's the aspiration of people in all these nation states that they should become the sovereigns and that their rulers would become the subjects. Nationalism is new. The first nation states are right up here. French Revolution, American Revolution. Before that, you have bishoprics, free cities, kingdoms, emirates, caliphates, shogunates, every kind of political concatenation, but not nation states. And in the last 200 years, the entire globe has been transformed, the political globe, into 193 nation states. The cookie cutter has been working at the globe. And that's been a violent process of rearranging how people are administered, who they identify with, how they identify themselves, and reducing these thousands of political entities into 193. Most nation states don't make it. I think there's 10 languages every year that disappear from the face of the earth that could be nations, but don't get to be nations. Most of those nation states, and in many schools, we teach that we're beginning into a post-national age, that the UN, transnational bodies, EU, these are the new organizations, and nationalism is yesterday. But that's not true. That's true if you live in Belgium. The world looks that way. But if you live out here in most, where most of people do, it's not true. Over 100 nation states get their independence from 1945 to 1973. And those countries that have just gotten their independence are working out where their borders are, who's in, who's out, and they're doing some ethnic cleansing, many of them, perhaps. So this is, nation states are modern. They're very recent, and most people are just coming through it. America, destroying Indians, having a civil war, killing 700,000 of our own citizens, is a century ago, in the past. For most countries, that's in living history if it's not looming in front of them. Now let's look at the post-Ottoman states. Let's go to what we're really interested in today, is what's happening in the Middle East, in the 11 states. I'm going to march you through very quickly. Here's Anatolia. Anatolia, Turkey, the head of the Ottoman Empire, is 20% Christian in 1914. By 1923, when Ataturk has consolidated his grip, modern Turkish nationalism has arrived, there are no Christians left. Today, there's less than 1% Christians in Anatolia. What happened to those 20%? We know what happened to the Armenians in the East. 1.5 to 2 million were accused of working with the Russians during World War I and being a fifth column to undermine the Ottoman Empire. They were marched out of Anatolia, most dying on the way, being preyed upon. Some of them get to Lebanon, Aleppo, and other places. The Greek Orthodox over here, Greece invades Anatolia at the end of World War I, thinking that because Anatolia is destroyed, they can recreate the Byzantine Empire. The Greek army marches all the way to almost Ankara, Sakarya River, before Ataturk has reorganized the Turkish nation, built an army again out of the flotsam of the Ottoman army that's been disbanded by the British. The British have occupied Istanbul, and begins to march the Greeks backwards. And in doing so, he destroys all the Greek Orthodox here. And 1.5 million are transferred and put on boats and sent to Greece. And 800,000 Greek Muslims are put on boats and taken to Anatolia. Big population exchange. One out of every four Greeks today is an Anatolian, or one out of every four, let's say 25% of the DNA of Greece comes from Anatolia at the end of World War I. Many of those Greek Orthodox flee down to Aleppo and to Syria and are undergoing another diaspora, if you will, in the present situation. But that gets rid of Greeks from Turkey. If we look at Cyprus, you see this great sorting out even more elegantly. Here is the map of Cyprus before the 73 Turkish invasion, before nationalism really lays its imprint. And the little green spots are Muslims. And there they are, beautifully sprinkled about amongst Christians in this mosaic of harmony. Nationalism, Turkish invasion, that's what the island looks like today. Every Muslim lives in the north, every Christian lives in the south. There is no intermixing at all. Stark demographic segregation. That's modern nationalism, the great sorting out. Lebanon, I'm not going to trouble you with because it's a little bit complicated. And it'll stall our progress here to getting to Iraq and Syria. Suffice it to say that in the 11 states, a variation takes place on this theme. The French get Syria and Lebanon. The British get Iraq, Jordan, Palestine. In every one of the 11 states, the colonial power gives the minorities a leg up because they need them to help rule. When they leave at the end of World War II, the minorities capture the state in every one of the 11 countries. And what you're seeing more recently is the majority ethnic group or religious group rise up and try to get rid of that minority with varying degrees of success. But it leads to sort of great sorting out in the Middle East. In Lebanon, it was the Christians who were given a leg up by the French, got the lion's share of power. Lebanese civil war was an attempt to get rid of that Christian domination of the state. 150,000 people killed out of 3 million Lebanese. 1 million displaced. Long and bloody. It's been very difficult. It's not over yet for Lebanon. Perhaps they will avoid. But Iraq, our minority of interest are the Sunnis. The Sunnis live in this yellow area in western Iraq. They're only 20% of the population. Shiite Arabs are 60% of the population, and Kurds up in the north are 20%. Kurds are a different ethnic group. They speak Indo-European language related to Persian. They don't speak a Semitic language like Arabic. Sunni Muslims were given power by the British. They had had it under the Ottomans, and Saddam Hussein was a Sunni. He built up the Ba'ath Party as an instrument of Sunni domination, the officer corps heavily Sunni, in the army and in the Ba'ath Party, dominated by Sunnis at the top. When America waltzed in 2003 to bring democracy, what they did was to take the Sunnis from the top of society, cast them down to the bottom, and catapult the Shiites from the bottom up to the top. Power sharing failed, and what you get is the unleashing of this great sorting out, a terrible religious and ethnic civil war that has led to combat between these three different groups. The Sunnis, who were horrified at being thrown out of their jobs and cast aside, marginalized, joined Al-Qaeda and began to try to kill Americans to get rid of them and capture the state again. America set about destroying those rebels, which they had largely done through the awakening by arming up tribes against Al-Qaeda. But then they leave in 2010, and ISIS builds out of the old Al-Qaeda guys who've gone to Syria, which falls into civil war, where they rebuild in eastern Syria, and they come back. And in 2014, ISIS sweeps through all the Sunni areas without a shot being fired, almost. They take Mosul, Ramadi, Tikrit. All of the big cities are captured by ISIS. And today, the United States then gears up again and begins to destroy these Sunni cities, one after the other, to reconquer them and to help very sectarian Shiite government retake these Sunni cities. And that's what's going on in Mosul today, up in the very far north area there, where there's 1 million inhabitants. All the Christians, 60,000 Christians of Mosul, left in one day in 2014 when that city was captured in the summer of 2014. And there were roadblocks and the ISIS guys took off their rings. It was just like Eastern Europe. I'm going to shoehorn Arab-Israeli conflict into this paradigm I'm drawing for you in 2 minutes. Jewish population of Palestine, 1850, about 5%. That's before the rise of Zionism. Cultural Zionism and so forth, 1915, 1914, World War I, about 15% Jewish. The British take it over, Balfour Declaration, Jewish homeland. By the end of World War II, by the time the British leave in 48, a third of the population is Jewish. The Palestinians think that they're going to be able to dominate because they're two-thirds of the population when the British leave. They fail spectacularly. The Yishuv, the British community, wins the war of 48. Two-thirds of the Palestinian population are driven out of the country or flee in front of this war, and not to be allowed to come back. The Jewish population of Palestine, which gets a leg up by the British, are the only minority that are able to turn themselves into a majority and dominate this new state. Now, to be fair to the Jews, they've already been sorted out. In Europe, 6 million dead and driven out of all of Central Europe. In the Middle East, the same thing has happened to the Jews. The Jews of Baghdad were the single largest religious community in 1914, bigger than Sunnis or Shiite or Kurds. There's not one Jew left in Baghdad. The Jews of Aleppo, Damascus, Yemen, Morocco, they're all gone. There's small Jewish communities left in Iran and Istanbul, but they're a shadow of their former selves. Half of all Israelis are Middle Eastern Jews who were sorted out of the Middle Eastern countries and driven out. Eli Kaddouri, one of the great doyens of Middle Eastern studies, Iraqi Jew, talked about how his community was destroyed between the hammer of Arab nationalism and the anvil of Zionism. And this led to the great sorting out. Let us turn to Syria, which is at the heart of our discussion today, the last one of these Levant countries. Syria, the minority of interest are the Alawites, living on the coast. When the French arrive in 1920, they're the poorest of the poor, 6 kilometers of graveled road in the entire area, only 24 had gone to high school. They flood into a French army that the French build and become overrepresented in the military. This is their leg up. When the French leave in 1946, the Alawites are the single largest minority group in the military. There are Armenians, there are Druze, Ismailis, Kurds, country Sunnis have all flooded into the army. But a bunch of coups from 49 to 70 leave the Alawites go up through the body of the army and reach the top officer corps. 1970, Hafs al-Assad takes power in a coup and establishes a state much like Saddam Hussein's. Ba'ath Party, single-party state, officer corps, or the upper ranks of it, are largely minoritarian and lots of Alawites. The military in particular, the upper ranks staffed by Alawites. The head of the Republican Guard is his brother. Traditional values, traditional loyalties are used to cement Alawite power at the top. And that survives through the son. Bashar takes power in 2000 when the father dies, up until the uprising in 2011. When the Sunni Arab population, 70% of Syrians are Sunni Arab, about 10% are Kurds, and then there are Christians and Alawites, Armenians, Druze, there's a bunch of different minorities, but religious minorities only make up about 20-22% of the population. They all, by and large, support Assad government. They're worried about Islamists taking over, and they're worried about ethnic cleansing. This great sorting out. They've seen what happened to the Sunnis in Iraq, and they've looked at the neighborhood. Rather than give up power, they shot, and they went to war to try to preserve their hold over the ramparts of the state and the security apparatus. Well, let me just stop for 2 seconds on Christians. This is the Christian population of the Middle East. It's emblematic of this great sorting out. What happens to minorities? We already heard about the Jews that have disappeared from the entire Middle Eastern. But here are Christians. Egypt, close to 20%, down to less than 10% Copts today. Syria was 15% after World War II. Today, there's probably 3% Christians left. Palestine, almost none. Iraq, crashed. Only countries that are gaining Christians are the Gulf countries. And of course, they're not citizens, they're just workers, teachers, engineers, so forth. So it's illusory. They're gone, by and large. That's the map today. ISIS is the dark gray in the middle. That's 2015 when ISIS is at its greatest extent. But what you're seeing, if we look at who lives where, this is Shiite Iraq, governed by Baghdad with American power behind it and Iranian power. The Kurds, of course, have created their own government in northern Iraq. The Peshmerga is the army. They fly their own flag. The kids speak Kurdish. They don't know Arabic anymore. If you're below 25 years of age, you don't speak Arabic in northern Iraq because Kurdish is taught in the schools and English is the second language and Arabic is a distant third. Nobody takes Arabic. Nobody cares about Arabic. And that's what's happening today in northern Syria. The Kurdish regions are run by the PYD, a Kurdish militia. 2 weeks ago, changed their curriculum from Arabic to Kurdish, and they're on their way to an independent nationhood if they can hold on to it, and if America sticks with them as an ally. But where is ISIS? ISIS conquered all the Sunni territory in between. Assad has held on to the cities, which are largely Sunni here, and so you get a class division of countrified Sunnis versus the city Sunnis, and rich people don't like revolutions. They're worried about losing their stuff, so they have largely remained passive under government authority. But here is this nation state that's created in the middle, stretching from Baghdad to Aleppo, a Sunni world. What is the United States trying to do? It's trying to preserve the borders at the danger of changing the people. Rather than allowing the state to come into existence, we're trying to recreate that border that was laid down in 1919 and to make Iraqi nationalism whole and make Kurds, Sunnis, and Shiites all live together in one nation power sharing. And we're trying to do the same thing with a political solution to Syria and make everybody share power who are shooting at each other today. That's the stated talking points. And we're using a lot of firepower to do it because we're destroying ISIS. We are killing Sunni rebels and helping a Shiite sectarian government in Baghdad. And in many ways, the Russians are doing something identical. They're helping a sectarian Shiite pro-Iranian government in Damascus kill Sunni rebels in Syria. So you've got the best air force helping Shiites in Iraq, and the second best air force, maybe the third or fourth, I don't know where Russian air force stands, but it's a bloody good one, are helping the Shiites' pro-Iranian government in Damascus do exactly the same thing in Syria. Not with as many smart bombs, not as intelligently, but it's leading towards the same thing. And ISIS is doomed. They don't have an air force. They're sitting ducks, and it's only a matter of time that they will be destroyed as a political entity. But where does that leave the Sunni Arabs sitting in the middle? A lot of them are fleeing. The refugees in Europe this summer, the first number come from Syria. They're almost all Sunnis. The second greatest number are from Iraq, and they're Sunnis. The third greatest number is from Afghanistan. Of course, they're Sunnis too, but they're being driven out of their homes because their cities are being destroyed. Ramadi, Tikrit, Deir's Tikrit, Ramadi, Fallujah, along this river here, have been destroyed in the last year by American firepower largely, but also by Shiite militias that have gone along with the Iraqi army. And 80% of the housing stock in those three cities is destroyed. The people who lived in them are sitting in the desert, drinking out of UN little bottles, being supplied in tent cities. The UN has built a tent city outside of Mosul that can house 400,000 people, waiting for the refugees to come out of Mosul as this war goes on, depending on how difficult it is to take it. But they're being turned into homeless people, being fed by the UN. Many of them will try to leave the country. So it's not ethnic cleansing, because America doesn't do ethnic cleansing, but it has to. I'm drawing my analogy, and maybe it's a bit of a Procrustean bread, with the sorting out that took place in Central Europe, nation-building process. And here in the Middle East, in the Levant, we're seeing that nation-building, the new ethnicity is religion. Shiites versus Sunnis. Of course, there is some old ethnicity with the Kurds just being a different ethnic group. But the minorities, Christians, Sabians, Yazidis, who were just destroyed recently, are all leaving because they don't have any protection. They don't have a possibility of creating their own nation state. The Assyrians are all fleeing and trying to get refuge in other places. As this is the titans of the area fight over who gets what and who's going to be on top, who's going to be on bottom. And they look at each other as a fifth column, as aliens who are destroying the nation. It's going to be very hard to find a political solution that rebuilds these nation states with power sharing today, because there is no occupying force that can help rebuild a nation over a long period of time. And the states have been destroyed. So people are mobilizing along these older sectarian ethnic lines rather than around Iraqi nationalism or Syrian nationalism. I'm going to try to end with a happy note. And I've searched a long time to find a happy note. In line with this notion of nationalism and national identity, we can look at Mama Merkel. The Syrians call her Mama Merkel because she let in almost a million, over half a million Syrians into Germany to become German citizens. And when you think of what's happened to German national identity in 65 short years, 65 years ago, Germany really sparked off this great sorting out in Central Europe by trying to dominate and put the Germans at the top. Very chauvinistic notion of nationalism. And today, killing the Semites. And today, welcoming in over half a million Semites to become German citizens. Of course, it's too late for the Jews. It's too late for all those people who were sorted out. But in a sense, it indicates that national identity can change very rapidly. The idea of who's in and who's out and how you can integrate can change very quickly. It is a moving target. And that's the little bit of hope or uplift that I could possibly bring to this story of great sorting out. Thank you.
While we're waiting for the questions to come up, Joshua, I'll start with the first one. How is this all going to play out?
Very good question. The question is, to what extent, given my talk and the argument I'm making, to what extent do Sunni Arabs get ethnically cleansed? Why are they losing so badly? We all thought, when this war started off after about a year, that the Alawites could not hold up. They're only 12% of the country, war of attrition. If the Sunni Arabs could just go on long enough, they would wipe them out. There'd be no more soldiers to serve. That 70% versus 12%. But to a certain extent, what's happened is that this is no longer a Syrian war. We were wrong in just thinking of Syria and Syrian demographic numbers. There are actually more Shiite Arabs that live from Lebanon to the other end of Iraq than there are Sunni Arabs. It's not by much, but this has turned into a regional war. And Hezbollah, southern Lebanon Shiite, has jumped in and helped in a big way. Iraqi militias, Shiite militias, have gone to Syria and are helping out. The Iranian army is in Syria for about 4,000 members of the Iranian army. So Shiite militias from all the surrounding countries see Syria and maintaining a Shiite dominance in Syria as crucial to their own national security, and they've been jumping in. Now, of course, the Sunnis set out a call of jihad and said, all Sunnis come to Syria and let's kill these unbelievers. But only 40,000 Sunnis answered the call, and America's been killing them as fast as they can find them. Because the Sunnis stupidly chopped off the heads of a few Americans and blew up cities in Paris and Brussels, they've turned the world against them. They made a crucial mistake. And although the United States sided with the Sunni rebels in the beginning against Assad, said Assad has to go, Sunni rebels are Democrats, we're going to be on your side, America has turned against the Sunni rebels because they have become jihadist increasingly. ISIS split off from Al-Qaeda, and America is bombing them today and helping the Shiites, even though it still says it's for Assad to leave and that Sunnis to win. But that's just talking points today because we're doing very little to make that happen. So how is this going to end up? If the war stops, the sooner it stops, the less Sunnis are ethnically cleansed. It's in the interest of the United States to end this war. How does it do that? Does it do that by shoveling in more arms, helping the rebels a little bit more, no-fly zones, or should it allow Russia to win and reassert state control? That's the choice, in a sense, that Washington faces today. Is its interference on the side of the rebels and encouraging Saudi Arabia and Turkey and others to put in more arms on the side of the rebels going to end this war, or is it going to prolong the suffering and cause more Sunnis to be driven out? And I would argue to you the latter. The longer this war goes on, more and more people will leave the country or be killed. And in some ways, the most merciful thing would be to allow the government, which is going to win, or which is winning today with Russian air power, to win. Even though that's a brutal answer. Assad is a dictator. He's brutal. But he's determined to take back his country. And the Russians are doing it, and America has not stood up to them. America, President Obama, a little over a year ago, when the Russians stepped in with their air power, said the United States will not fight a proxy war with Russia for Syria. And when he said that, it was very clear what was going to happen, that the Russians were going to get Assad to win. And unless America wants to fight a proxy war with Russia for Syria, which I don't think it does, and I don't think many of you are willing to pay for it or want to pay for it, then America shouldn't be into the process of just prolonging the war to get some little advantage, leverage in some possible political solution down the road 2 or 3 years from today.
I've got a question on ISIS. What will the relationship between a fallen or politically collapsed ISIS and Sunni tribes look like? What will become of ISIS when it's defeated in Mosul?
Well, many of the Sunni tribes participated. The tribes of this central desert area have participated in ISIS. And this is why the revenge is so brutal. As the Shiite militias and army retake these cities, they don't trust any of the Sunnis. They look around at the Sunnis and they think, you're an ISIS person, you're an ISIS person. So they have very little mercy. And they've been taking revenge, blowing up their houses to punish them. Question in Mosul is, can America stop this from happening? And we're trying to keep out all Shiite militias and just have the Iraqi army participate. But the Iraqi army is almost as sectarian as these militias. Perhaps not quite. But they're all Shiites at the top, and they're going to blow. Rather than walk into a house and search it, they'll throw in a few grenades, make sure it isn't booby-trapped. And that's the difficulty. And many of the Shiite tribes that live cheek by jowl with the Sunni tribes don't trust the Sunnis anymore because they were killed by the Sunni, their Sunni neighbors. So this deep distrust makes it very difficult. Now, I suppose the tribes will have to go into denial and say, no, we aren't with them, we refuse, and they'll have to kiss the hand of whatever army comes into their town and be very hangdoggy. And that's what they have to do if they want to survive. And they'll be ruled over by the Shiites, and if they are supplicant enough, they'll survive. If they refuse and they resist, they're going to run into trouble. And that's what's going to happen. I think it's going to be very brutal.
Okay, here's one about the Kurds. If Kurdistan in northern Iraq, if that succeeds as a separate state, how long until the Turkish Kurds decide to flee Turkey and join the new nation state or try to attach the Kurdish part of Turkey to the Iraqi Kurdistan?
Iraqi Kurdistan is already made. Turkey has good relations with the leaders of Iraqi Kurdistan. Turkish businessmen have built most everything in Kurdistan. They see Iraqi Kurdistan as a bridgehead into the Middle East. It's become an ally. Even though Erdogan said, we don't want to see an independent Iraqi Kurdistan, he switched. And he realized the Kurds could be turned into an ally. The trouble is the Syrian Kurdistan. The PYD runs it, and they're an offshoot of the PKK, the Turkish Workers' Party, which is organized around Turkish Kurds. And this is a branch of the Turkish Kurds organization, which Turkey defines as a terrorist organization. Turkey's been at war with for the last 40 years. 40,000 Kurds and Turks have been killed over the last 40 years in an ongoing war for Kurdish autonomy or quasi-independence or independence. So Turkey looks at this organization as deadly. The United States looks at these Kurds as friends who have helped the United States attack ISIS. And this is what's happened to ISIS over the last year and a half. From that big map where they are the size of Great Britain, their state has lost 14% in 2015, another 16% of their land was lost in 2016. So all those red areas are gone to ISIS. They lost to ISIS. And who took them? The Kurds. And ISIS attacked Kobani, which was the big turning point. Kobani is a city of 200,000 Kurds. ISIS had surrounded it and had almost ethnically cleansed the entire city, who had fled into Turkey. The Turkish tanks and everything were sitting over the border, and they would not help the Kurds. And in fact, they were arming and allowing ISIS to go over their border and to go through Turkey, because Erdogan saw this as a cheap way to destroy Kurdistan, which he saw as the number one threat to Turkey. The United States jumped in and began arming the Kurds in defiance of Turkey and helped the Kurds get a win in Kobani. This became the big turning point for Obama. And we reconquered it for the Kurds. And that began the beginning of this relationship with the Syrian Kurds. And today, we've helped them cross the Euphrates River, capture Manbij. American Special Forces rode with them, the PYD fighters, and they conquered all of this area in here at great cost to themselves from ISIS. This infuriated Erdogan. Here's a zoom-in picture of northern Aleppo. Aleppo's down here. but this is that northern area because this is Kurdish over here, Kobani and Minbij, and this is Afrin. It's a Kurdish enclave that's separate from this big long stretch of Kurdistan. And the Kurds want desperately to break through this Arab zone that's owned by ISIS and unite this entire area to have one contiguous Kurdish state stretching from the Iraqi border all the way to the other end of Syrian border. They would like to keep on going and go to the sea over here, the Mediterranean, and actually have a port. That's dreaming. But they're dreaming big. Why not dream big? The Turks said, no way. We're not going to let you unite these two. And the Turks invaded. Under the name of invading ISIS and helping America, they came in here in order to stop the advance of the Kurds and to stymie America's relationship with the Kurds. So this put Turkey at odds with the United States. But we need Turkey, NATO country, big ally. We can't forsake Turkey. So we said, okay, that's good. You're fighting ISIS. We like you. This is Operation Euphrates Shield. That's what they called it. And that means that they're going to kick the Kurds out of Minbij in this whole area west of the Euphrates. That means they're going to come and attack America's allies that special forces helped take this area at great expense. And I guess we'll let them do it because we have to manage these two relationships and we can't choose the Kurds over the Turks. Kurdish Twitter, everything has lit up saying you're stabbing us in the back, hateful Americans, no good nicks, you know, every curse word under the sun. And that's what's going on in social media today because the Kurds are trying to embarrass the Americans into saying, no, I don't like Turkey. I want the Kurds to live and have an independent nation. But of course, America's not going to get embarrassed, maybe a little bit. And that's what's happening. So that purple area has been conquered by Turkey. It's actually, they've been continuously conquering down this way, and they're about 14 miles from El Bab, which is the major city north of Aleppo, crossroads, hub, and everybody has their eyes on El Bab. The Kurds want it. The Syrian government says Turkey better not take it with the Russians. The Turks said we're going to take it. So that's going to be a major flashpoint where all three of these armies come together. At real stake for the United States is down here. Here's Raqqa over here, the capital of ISIS in Syria is Raqqa, a desert city. The United States wants to destroy that city like it does Mosul. Carter, Secretary of Defense, just said 3 or 4 days ago, we are going to begin the campaign against Raqqa within a few weeks. Who's going to take Raqqa for the Americans? Americans can bomb, but they can't take because we don't want to put boots on the ground. American people demanding that Obama destroy ISIS, but they refuse to let him have any army troops. So Obama has to just bomb the hell out of them. And that means he has to find a partner who will be the troops on the ground. And President Obama has three offers on the table. He has an offer by the Kurds who said, we will take Raqqa, but you have to officially endorse an autonomous Kurdistan. If you say that you support an autonomous Kurdistan and you will help us against the Turks, maintain that, we will take Raqqa for you tomorrow. America can't say that. But I presume that when Carter says this, he means the Kurds are going to help him take it. The Turks said, we would like to take Raqqa, and if you support us, that means that the Turks will then be able to smash the Kurds as they do it. So we're loath to say yes. Now, Syria and Russia have also offered. Assad and Russia said, we want to take Raqqa. It's our city. We're the legitimate government. All these other people are terrorists that you're supporting, an insurgency that's illegal. We're the only legal force. If you help them take it, you're breaking every law of international law, which is, of course, correct. But America does not want to help Russia and Assad take Syria. So we have three options. It's not like we don't have options. We just don't like any of them. We don't like any of the major actors in Syria. We look at all of them as difficult allies, to say the least. And that's our dilemma. And that's good for the Kurds in some ways and bad for them in others. It's good for the Kurds because Syria is likely to remain weak and fragmented for a long time, and that's good. If you're a Kurd, you want weak neighbors who cannot destroy your emerging nation state. But of course, Turkey is the big danger for the Kurds. So you need America. You need to win American support because America created Kurdistan in northern Iraq with a no-fly zone and support. America can do the same thing for the Kurds in Syria. If they want to have leverage in Syria in the future, they need to help the Kurds, build bases there, and make that their little aircraft carrier in the middle of the Middle East. If you're a Kurd, you hope Turkey is falling out of the Western orbit and NATO and so forth, and you want to be replace Turkey. If you're a Kurd, that's what you want to do. be very nice to America, and try to hope your neighbors stay weak.
What exactly would you recommend to newly elected President Clinton as the best U.S. policy in Syria? And there's another one that says, what would you recommend? If you were the Secretary of State, what would you do in Syria?
Right. Well, I sort of gave that away early on. I think I would bow out of Syria. Because what America has been doing is helping the rebels enough so they don't lose, but not enough so they can win. And that has prolonged the civil war and made Syrians hopeless about any resolution, one way or the other. And lots of Syrians have just abandoned and become refugees because they don't see any end coming, even if they've disillusioned with all the sides. Many of those refugees would go home if they felt there was a resolution, no matter who the dictator was going to be. America has no interest in winning this war. They're not going to try to win because they don't like the rebels. At the heart of the rebel in this area down here, which is Idlib province, Idlib is owned by al-Nusra militia, which is al-Qaeda branch. They have ensconced themselves, al-Qaeda, at the heart of the rebel conglomerate of militias. And America has tried to separate moderates from these Islamist jihadist wings, and they failed. And the jihadists are by far the strongest militias, with the most experienced, the most capable armies. So America doesn't really want them to win. It wants to use them to pressure Assad, get leverage, but it doesn't want them to take Damascus. Otherwise, America would have helped them win a long time ago. So we don't have a solution for Syria. The Russians are saying Assad's going to win. We're going to conquer everything. Just last week, Russians said we're going to take back all of Syria for Assad. Does America want to stop that? That's the real question. And I would say it doesn't really have an interest in stopping that. It's like Afghanistan in 79. The United States probably should not have taken Afghanistan away from Russia, should have left it with the Russians. There would have been no al-Qaeda, no Taliban, and all the headaches that ensued from that. Now, that analogy is not necessarily good, but it is an analogy. What is America's interest in Syria? We want to destroy ISIS and al-Qaeda. The Russians will do that, in theory. Of course, they'll replace it with a mean dictatorship. And that gets us down to whether regime change is the right policy in the Middle East, whether democracy is in the future, and whether America can make something better.
So, Josh, to pursue this for a moment, then, you believe Hillary Clinton's stated position of having a no-fly zone, establishing the United States establishing a no-fly zone over northern Syria is a big mistake.
I do, and I don't think that she is going to move ahead with a no-fly zone. And if she does, she'll do it in some tricky way that is not very useful. Because she came out with a no-fly zone early, before the Russians had taken the side of Assad. Today, the Russian Air Force is in Syria, and the Russians are making it very clear that they will escalate. They put in all kinds of anti-aircraft missiles. They've got their Air Force on a permanent basis. The Russian parliament has just okayed a permanent presence of Russia in Syria. They're trying to indicate to Washington, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. Now, maybe they're bluffing, and Putin will just put his tail between his legs and go away. But maybe they aren't. So that's the danger. There's a danger of escalation. There's a second danger, which is, let's say you put in a no-fly zone over this territory. There are hundreds of militias in that no-fly zone. And there's a Syrian army. Let's say you just say, no airplanes over my zone. That's not going to stop the fighting. Everybody's got lots of howitzers and cannons and so forth, and mortars. They're going to continue to kill each other. Then what do? The purpose of a no-fly zone is to protect the people underneath that no-fly zone. Then you have to go down the ground and protect them. You have to stop them from shooting each other. Then if you want to put in the NGOs, all going to want to take food in there. That means you have to protect the NGO people. And all the militias are going to want that food. They're going to say, you give the food to me, I'll distribute. I'm the number one guy here, and I'm going to be the new government. And you give it to me, I'll give it to the Syrians. And then you have to agree. You know, you have to decide, do I want to do that and make one militia? Do you pick a militia? What if it's al-Qaeda militia or an Islamist? Who are the strongest militias? Do you kill them first and then say, I'm going to get a moderate militia in there? The question is, you have to nation build, and you have to send in a police force. And then the question is, do you want to make that bigger until it includes all of Syria? Because all of the rebels and the activists will be saying, do that. Don't, you know, what about the people over here? Aren't you going to protect them? And pretty soon, there's going to be a lot of pressure on you to broaden. So it has a slippery slope aspect to it. What are your real objectives? Are you going to nation build in just one small part of Syria, or are you going to do that for all of Syria? And why choose these people and not those people? Which militia do you want to win you have to make those choices. So no-fly zone sounds good on humanitarian terms, but politically, it's very unclear what your objectives are ultimately. And none of those are ever stated in these plans for no-fly zone.
With the refugee migration north, the nationalist mentality grows in Europe. Are Europeans due for a new sorting with the migration? And here's a related one. What are the ramifications of a great sorting in Germany, France, and other Western European countries?
You know, everybody worries about Eurabia. I guess that's the new word for a Muslim-occupied Europe. I don't, you know, France is, I guess, 6%, 5, 6% Muslim. European nation states are pretty sturdy, especially Western Europe. They can absorb these immigrants. The United States has absorbed lots of immigrants. And of course, it gets nervous when the number gets close to 20%. But Western nationalism is so different. If I were going to give this a little bit of a long-winded answer, there's two types of nationalism. There's patriotism in the West, nationalism in Eastern Europe. Western nations were created by very powerful states. If you look at France, Spain, Holland, England, strong monarchs, absolutist monarchs that had conquered territory and turned their people into Frenchmen, into Spaniards, created the nation over hundreds of years of legalisms, constitution, geography. Eugene Weber wrote a wonderful book about French peasants into Frenchmen, and he argues that it wasn't until 1870 that more than 50% of Frenchmen actually spoke French that a Parisian could understand. You had Bretagne, you had, you know, Languedoc and Basque and Italian and German up in the north and tons of different dialects. So that process of building a nation state can be done by a strong state over a long time, learning how to write a language in public schools and so forth. And that's what the United States has done. And our sense of nationalism is based on geography. If you're born here, you get to be American. And if you pledge allegiance to that Constitution, there's a legalistic aspect to being an American. It's not because your blood is Anglo-Saxon, for example, or German. Eastern Europe, it's not a long state that builds the nation. It's the nation is posited first, and then the state is created to govern that nation. So, for example, Germans, Italians, Slavs didn't have a state. Germans had 33 different countries after Napoleon had sorted them out to a certain degree, but it was Bismarck that creates Germany. But the Germans had to invent a German national idea and then get a state to govern those Germans. And that's why you get Hans Christian Andersen collecting all the folk tales to say this is what real Germanism is. Beethoven with the folk music, creating these wonderful German things. And the romanticism of German nationalism. And then, of course, it leads to a Völkisch, racist national identity that's built on ethnicity. And then Hitler is going to go and try to capture all those Germans out there and put them inside one nation. So it's a very chauvinistic racial. It's not legalistic. And that's Eastern European. That's Italian, that's German, Slavic, so forth. And that's the Middle Eastern nationalism. Because there's no state after the Ottoman Empire is destroyed, all of these different religions and ethnicities are trying to build their own state. And they're defining it in these very chauvinistic ways. So yes, there's going to be a few Arabs coming to Central Europe, to Europe, Western Europe, or to the United States, but they're going to meld into this legal identity that's really been created. Now, of course, in this election cycle, we've seen an attempt to reanimate various identity politics. The biggest one is probably men versus women, so we don't have to worry about it so much. But there are many others. In a sense, the US answer, which is all men are created equal, has been an extremely powerful idea. And when Hillary Clinton steps up and says, no, we're not going to exclude Muslims, we're not going to exclude these various national identities because it's against our Constitution and we believe in this, that all men are created equal, Americans embrace that. Not everybody, but a lot of them do, because it is very powerfully embedded in our identity. Let me end with a little uplift, because my favorite Lincoln speech takes place in the Civil War, big battle, lots of dead Americans, he's burying them, and he gives a eulogy. And he talks to soldiers who he wants to go off and fight the next battle and encourage them to do so. And he says, Most of you came to this nation after the founding fathers. You don't belong to them by blood. Why would you sacrifice? And he says, because our blood are the ideas embedded in the Constitution, that all men are created equal. If you believe in those ideas, you have American blood in you. And you will go off and fight for those ideas. And that's who we are. It's not the blood, it's the ideas that are running in our veins. And that's a moving concept, but it's also a concept that has held us together despite us being all these different identities. And it's a powerful concept. And the older states of Western Europe have done something similar. Of course, it's mixed. It's never one or the other. But those are powerful. They're winning combinations. They have been winning, and they will continue to win for the foreseeable future. Thank you.